Tango Tango Papa 1825, March the 1st, 2014.
Have we seen the actual reality of a monstrous crime? Or merely an illusion, the product of a tortured brain?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Tom Wiles here with you, coming to you this evening from Russellville, Arkansas, back at work. So today is Saturday, the 1st, March the 1st. I came back to work this evening. of course, I was ready to go back to work this morning. And then they sent a load that picked up here in Russellville, and it turned out it's a live load, and it has two drops. The first one is in early Monday morning in Buda, Texas, and then the second one is Tuesday morning in San Antonio, Texas. So in the meantime, I called the place here where I'm picking the load up this morning. I called them, and I knew it was going to be in the evening, and she told me, don't show up before 8 p.m. So I ended up getting here at 9 p.m. since I didn't have to leave right away, I've been thinking about phones lately, and I have been thinking about phones. I watched the recent presentation, the Samsung presentation that they made with the pre-announcement of the Galaxy S5. And of course, that's not available for sale until mid-April. And so I thought about that, and I thought, well, I could probably wait. But in the meantime, I've been kind of looking at the Note 3, the Galaxy Note 3, and the S5 has a slightly faster processor. It has a 2.5 gigahertz quad-core processor, whereas the Note 3 has a 2.3 gigahertz quad-core processor. So, I don't know. I was kind of thinking about that. And then, now while I was home, I was putting up a bunch of videos, and I kind of been experimenting with it. I was able to buy I have this one microphone. It's called a lavalier, and the idea, it's a small microphone, and it actually has a little clip, and it clips to your lapel. Or in my case, it's clipping to the collar of my shirt. And the idea being that microphone's right there, you get much better audio. You can get farther away instead of using the built-in microphone and the camera. And in my case, the camera is the phone. Instead of using the built-in microphone, use the lavalier microphone. And so I was able to buy an adapter that would plug into the headset jack on the phone, and I found out that S3, the 720p video, is it comes across as being okay, but then the audio, if you push it very hard, it does introduce some distortion. And so I experimented with that briefly with one of the videos that I put up, and using that lavalier microphone plugged into the phone as I was recording video with it, and it introduced some noise that would kind of periodically, ever so often, every few seconds, it would kind of come back. And so there was that, and it was kind of, you know, that kind of made me realize that maybe I could do better with the audio on those videos that I'm putting up. And then also, the other thing, of course, I've been thinking, periodically I would think, well, maybe I could wait for the next iPhone release in the fall and perhaps get an iPhone. Maybe there's going to be a bigger screen and so on and so forth. And let's face it, Apple makes some pretty nice stuff that usually it works pretty well. But with the video that I put up, the last one that I made while I was home, I had different things that I'd been meaning to make review videos with, and so I just kind of knocked one out each day. And so the last one that I put up was I actually, as an experiment, I recorded it with the iPad Air, and of course the iPad Air's got a nice 5-megapixel camera on the back, and so it records very nice video. So I recorded the video with it, even though it's a little bit awkward, you know, kind of using the iPad Air in the case and what have you. It's a little awkward because with the case, especially the keyboard case, it's somewhat heavy and it's clunky because it's, because of the form factor and what have you, especially with the keyboard case attached. And, of course, I could have taken it out and used it that way, but it's, you know, I just used it with the case. Be that as it may, I recorded was able to record the video with the iPad. Now, one of the quirks the iPad has, even if it's recording HD video, is that while you're recording, it looks like it's 4:3. And it's only after you've recorded it and when you play it back, that you realize, oh, well, it's 16:9. So that's one of the weird little quirks, and I've never heard anybody mention that. Of course, the iPad has it's a 4:3 format screen and not 16:9. But that's just a little quirk and it's really irrelevant. But it recorded very nice video. And so I was able to use the iMovie app to easily edit the thing together and spit the final video out. And I did that last night, you know, with the idea that I was going to put the video up, upload it to YouTube this morning. And so I went to the camera roll on the iPad, and one of the options is to export, and so to share, and so I tapped on that, and there's a YouTube icon there, and it pops up with an error message, and it says, "Your video is too long. You're going to have to cut part of it out." Well, oh no, I'm not. And so I was able to use the YouTube uploader, the iOS YouTube uploader. I was able to use that and go ahead and upload the video. It was about 20 minutes long because I demonstrated the scanner, the document scanner that I bought, got that the last time I was home. And so I demonstrated it, and then I talked about the scanner and so on and so forth. So, you know, kind of a little bit longer video, but I was able to upload it with the iOS YouTube loader. But just the idea that Apple would, this video's too long. You're doing it from the camera roll? Too long, sorry. It's like they're either trying to get at Google, you know, kind of get back at Google, or who knows what they're trying to do. Apple, and then that's the other thing, and I've thought about this. Apple, it's like they're enticing you into their garden, or they're enticing you into their, you know, come in and look at these wonderful products we have. We have the, you know, a Mac, and it's got OS X, and it doesn't have any spyware or viruses, and it's secure and so on and so forth. And it really is, and it's a nice operating system. But they get you in, and then you know the equivalent is you buy the thing, and so in the meantime they get you in there and they close the door and they lock it behind you, and so you're kind of trapped. And then once you're in there, not only are you trapped, but then they, oh, look over here in this corner, look in the next room, we've got this new version, and it's going to do this, and it's going to do that, and you install that, and by the way, we've taken, you know, they close the door behind you and lock it again. Kind of a room inside of a room, and they've, in other words, they've taken some things away. Whatever they gave you, they took something else away. They always do that. Anytime they add features, they take something away. And sometimes those things that they take away are very important to a certain segment of the user base. That, I find that very irritating. That is one of the reasons why, by the way, that Windows was so successful for so many years. Now, not so much now, because they're trying to become Apple. As far as what they've done with, especially with Windows 8, they're trying to kind of play the Apple game, and it's not. And of course, Microsoft cannot be Apple. They need to stick with being Microsoft and not try to become Apple, because they're never going to beat Apple at their own game. But the thing that made Windows successful was the fact that it was open. And they really worked at keeping things backwards compatible all those years. So, but what, you know, and then, but Apple, you know, they get you in there and then they close the door and lock it behind you. So you're sort of trapped. It'd be like sort of, kind of another analogy, you'd get on the freeway and there's very few exits, and you just have to, you're just kind of stuck. As long as you bought into the ecosystem, you bought into the hardware, you know, into their hardware and software, and you're just sort of stuck there, and then they've got control of you whether you like it or not. So, you know, and if you don't like it, then the other people in the groupthink group will all try to shout you down. And I'm talking about the Apple fanboy. They'll all shout you down. You know, blah, blah, blah. I've had them do that before. So, you know, and they'll come up with every excuse in the book as to why Apple is great, and they do what they do, and you just have to live with it. Well, sorry, I don't. So that was kind of what helped me decide I was going to, you know, instead of buying an iPhone, forget it. I don't want an iPhone. I don't want to be locked in. I would rather have an open platform, that's one that's truly open, that any app can be put on there. I was watching this show on Netflix last night. It was originally aired on Bloomberg, and it was this gal interviewing. There's a CEO. The Chinese search company is gigantic Chinese search company called Baidu. And that is the equivalent of Google in China. Of course, Google tried to be in China. At one time, Google had a 30% share of the Chinese search market, and then that ended up dropping. And in 2010, Google pulled out of the Chinese market completely. But Baidu already had a huge and growing market share, and now they really dominate. And it's a $50 billion. It's valued at $50 billion in China. So, this woman was interviewing the guy that started it, the founder and the CEO, and very intelligent man. He you know, had lived in the U.S. for about 10 years. He spent some time in New Jersey, Princeton, New Jersey, and then I don't remember where else he said. But she was asking him different questions, you know, about technology and so on and so forth. And one of the questions she was asking was about, well, you know, Apple has not had very good success in China. And the guy was saying at one time they had 15% market share for the smartphone market in China, but now it's dropped down to 4%. And she asked him, well, what are they doing wrong? Well, he said one of the things that's wrong is that Apple has their input screen, you know, the alphabet, you know, like if you're English, you know, you have the English alphabet and it pops up, you get the little QWERTY equivalent keyboard that pops up that you tap your fingers on or your thumbs to type in, the on-screen keyboard. Well, of course, Chinese, you know, you have the Chinese characters and you have a Chinese keyboard, and he said that the Chinese keyboard is really lousy. It really leaves something to be desired on the iPhone, on iOS, even the new version, iOS 7. It leaves something to be desired. And then the other thing, Apple will not allow third-party developers to upload alternative keyboards to the App Store. So you're just kind of, unless you jailbreak your iPhone, you're just sort of stuck with this inferior on-screen Chinese character keyboard. That's one of the things that's killing them. And of course, they just insist on, you know, they being Apple, and they do their things their way or whatever, and they're losing market share in China. And the other thing he said is the Chinese people, the Chinese smartphone consumers, really like to have larger screens. And so he said his wife, this guy's wife, uses an iPhone. She loves her iPhone, but he said he has a Note 3, a Galaxy Note 3. And that he's using this Note 3 pretty much, a lot, pretty much instead of a PC. And of course, a lot of people are doing that. So that was another thing. But so Apple, makes some nice products. I do not see myself ever getting an iPhone anytime soon. Especially with the, it seems to me that Apple really is, whenever Steve Jobs died, I said at the time that there was a good chance that Apple would think that, that Steve Jobs' idiosyncrasies were what made Apple successful and what made Steve Jobs successful. And it was not his idiosyncrasies. The man was brilliant, obviously. He had some real character faults otherwise. But he was brilliant, and he succeeded in spite of his these quirks that he had. And the tendency is going to be for Apple to think that the quirks were what made them, what made the thing successful. And the innovator, of course, is now gone. He was able to. He was successful in spite of his quirks. And sort of eccentricities. And a tendency to kind of lock people in and so on and so forth and screw with their minds. The tendency is that they're going to turn, and it's going to become more and more and more of a sort of a caricature of what they thought he was and what they thought that made him successful. And that seems to be what they're turning into, because it seems to me that they're getting worse and worse about trying to lock people in. So we'll see how that goes. Of course, they're still selling lots of products. And they're still successful. They got billions and billions and billions of dollars in the bank. They're not going to go away anytime soon. Talking about Apple. So, but at the same time, China is the big market now, and they're losing market share pretty rapidly. They went from 15% to 4% of the Chinese smartphone market. Not a good trend. That's not the direction you want to go in if you want to be successful. And China is the big market now at this point, and it's gonna become a bigger market, and it's gonna dominate the world at some point. Really, it's really set to really be the dominant market in the world. So I don't know, but I've got 4 Macs, I've got 2 Mac Minis, one that I use as a DVR, the other that I use as a computer that I put the 250 gigabyte SD drive in. Then I've got a MacBook Pro that's 17 inch that I'm kind of not using as much anymore, and I'm not even bringing it with me because it's I really don't need it, need to bring that with me. I could just leave it at home. And then I've got this 13-inch plastic, white plastic MacBook that I've had for a number of years that I bought, you know, I bought, actually it was used, it was about at least a year old, I bought from a friend. And it hasn't been used all that much, and a little over a year ago I put a 128 gigabyte SSD drive into it, and it sped it up so much, and it makes it such a good performer that that's the machine that I use now. And it, and like I say, it hadn't been used very much, and so the thing's got lots and lots of life left in it. Probably more than the 17-inch MacBook Pro, even though it's newer, because I used it so much. And so it's kind of getting long in the tooth, the 17-inch machine is. So I just kind of leave it at home and use it occasionally now. So I have all the Macs that I need. And in the meantime, tablets and smartphones are becoming ever more powerful. And so by the time these Macs completely die that I have already, I really don't see a need to buy another one, because at that, you know, in a few years, as fast as the technology market is moving now, within just a few years, I'm not going to need a desktop computer or a laptop computer. I just probably won't need it, because the smartphones and the tablets have become so powerful at this point, and then it's a matter of kind of getting the software up to speed. It's all become so powerful that it's probably going to supersede, in many instances, it's really going to end up superseding the need for a tablet or for a computer, of, you know, either a desktop or a laptop. And I really don't see my, you know, I might buy another iPad at some point. That's always possible. But I don't see myself buying an iPhone. So, but what ended up happening today? I went to Best Buy and I looked at phones. And, you know, of course, they have a large Samsung area in there, and they've got all these different phones and tablets on display, and you can actually play with them. And, you know, they've got, they're alive, and you can play with them. And so I experimented with the Note 3. Primarily, I wanted to do an experiment on the audio and see how the audio quality was, and it passed the test with flying colors. So I was prepared to buy one, but Best Buy, in the meantime, their cellular area, of course they sell four major carriers in there, their cellular area was already swamped with people, and it, you know, so I decided there's also a Sprint store that's just a few miles away, so I went over to the Sprint store, and I was actually able to get right in. Now, while I was there, it got really busy. There were, by the time I got out of there was lots of people waiting in line, but I was pretty much in and out of there fast. That's the fastest that's never happened, you know, where I've bought a phone. That really happened pretty quickly. So I was in and out of there, and so I went ahead and went back over to the Best Buy store because they have a better selection of cases, and I ended up buying it's a black, it sort of looks like leather, and I'm sure it's made out of some kind of plastic or polycarbonate of some sort. But it's a case, and it basically fits on the back of the Note 3 and the sides. It kind of clips on the back and the sides. And it doesn't add very much bulk to the phone at all. Very little bulk that it adds, and that's what I wanted. I didn't want something gigantic and bulky. And so I had a choice between that, and then there was another one that was constructed pretty much exactly the same way, with the exception that it was using sort of a clear, translucent plastic. And I went ahead and got this black one that because it, you know, it has, it's sort of like a leather, you know, because it has sort of a textured back. You know, it's easier probably to keep a hold of. So, I after that, then I got something to eat, and then I went on back home and spent some time downloading apps and making sure everything got transferred over. By the way, there's an app that Samsung has that's pretty interesting. I'd never really knew about it. If you've got a Galaxy phones, you know, because there's a number of different Galaxy phones, you download it from the Google App Store, and I don't remember exactly the name of it, but you put it on both phones, both devices, and then the thing will, you start it up, and then on both phones, and then it does kind of a handshake. But the really, really interesting thing is that it's doing it through sound. And it's obviously ultrasonic sound, because, you know, above the human hearing, can't hear it. But it's using sound. It does a handshake through sound, and then I think it's transferring the data through sound, which is remarkable. And it does it quick. So I was able to select everything, you know, photos and contacts and favorite internet browser favorites and text message, SMS text messages, which includes pictures and the phone logs and all of those things, select everything. And within just a matter of a few minutes, I was able to transmit it all to the new phone, which is pretty neat. Because otherwise it could be a big problem trying to copy things over, you know, plug them into a computer or whatever and try to copy them over through a computer. You know, this way it goes directly from one phone to the other, and it said that they had to be no more than about 10 feet apart, and fairly, you didn't want a lot of background noise because that could interfere. So with the since it's going through sound. But I was really impressed by the speed with which it was able to, you know, because I had like half a gigabyte worth of photos and, you know, so on and so forth. And so it transferred that pretty quickly. So that's pretty amazing. So anyway, got all that done. And so I got the phone pretty much customized the way I want it and with the stuff that I want on it. And so I didn't even bother bringing the old phone. I'm going to give the S3 to my youngest brother. Just go ahead and give it to him. So so I got a new phone. And so I don't know. I could have waited until mid-April, but I wanted the new phone. And I kind of like the Note 3. I'm going to have to get used to saying that. Has a 5.7 inch screen, whereas this new Galaxy S5 will have a 5.1 inch screen. So, you know, and another thing that's really remarkable about this Note 3, and I think probably the Galaxy S5 will be able to do it too, the Note 3 can record 4K video. That's, you know, that 4K video is what 4K is what you, when you go to the digital, you know, the modern digital cinema, that's what you're watching is 4K. So it's actually able to record 4K. Now, of course, it's doing it, you know, it's a phone and it's got a little tiny lens. It's a phone doing it, but that's still quite remarkable that a phone can do that, because I guarantee you that, you know, even a lot of laptop or desktop computers, if you ask them to process that much information, they're going to choke. So it's really remarkable that a phone can do that. So I don't know, that's pretty interesting. So the Note 3 has some, you know, it's a pretty remarkable piece of hardware. And it really has gone beyond, you know, even though Apple goes on and on and on, and they really know how to promote the features that they have. In many ways, the S3 has surpassed the iPhone, you know, the iPhone. It's they've kind of left Apple behind, and in many cases they're just kind of been left behind. But Apple, of course, is great at PR, and they're great at hyping things, and you know, and the fanboy types are really great at you know, just repeating things over and over again and trying to outshout everybody. But so in any case, I'm happy with this Note 3. It's really snappy, great performer. Pretty happy with it, and so I did end up switching. And I stayed with Sprint. I was thinking about jumping ship and maybe going to Verizon at some point, but Sprint's network is getting better, and it would have cost me about $100, at least $100 more to pay the early termination fee, and then, you know, get a phone with Verizon. So it's just, I don't know. And besides that, I'm using mostly Verizon data anyway, most of the time. And then Sprint's data is getting better. They are their 4G is appearing in a lot more places, so it's getting better. So I decided I'd just go ahead and stick with Sprint. Anyway, I've got an interesting it's a video, but audio. And this was originally a CNN report, I think, from sometime probably, I'm guessing, it looks like it may be in the, I don't know, maybe late 70s possibly. I'm not sure when CNN first started up, but this video is pretty old. And the style, you know, the hairstyles and what have you, they just scream probably maybe sometime in the 70s, you know, or maybe early 80s possibly. But it's interesting. They're talking about this. This video is about 14 minutes 33 seconds. They're talking about this metal called nitinol, and they'll kind of explain what it is. And it's pretty interesting. It was, you know, quite an interesting video. And this is really an interesting metal. So I'm going to go ahead and play this. So here it is.
This giant complex of buildings overlooking San Francisco Bay is the Lawrence Laboratory at Berkeley. Some of the world's most advanced research in theoretical and practical physics is being done here. For some years now, a small group of scientists attached to the laboratories have been investigating this, a curious metal called nitinol. It has certain anomalous properties not yet fully understood or explained. It's caused considerable interest, it has generated some controversy, and it now seems that in a world searching for new sources of energy, it may have profound consequences. Research began here in a small laboratory workshop 7 years ago when it was discovered that nitinol had apparently unique properties. The head of the laboratories was Nobel Prize-winning physicist Professor Edwin McMillan.
Can you explain what it is we're going to see?
Well, this is a piece of nitinol which was made in the shape of a coil spring. And the property of nitinol is that it when it's hot and wants to get back to the shape it was when it was made. When it's cold, it's quite relaxed and will take any shape. This is now cold, and you see I can take it and stretch it out.
So it was made in the shape.
It was made in the shape that I showed you first. Now it's cold, I can stretch it. Here I have a glass of hot water, and if I just pour the hot water on this thing, you see what happens. There we are. Good as new. In the cool state, it's relaxed and floppy. In the heated state, it remembers its former state. That's why you say it has a memory. So if you make the thing, if you make this piece of wire so it's straight when you made it, then when it's hot, it wants to straighten out. When it's cold, it's just as floppy as a wet noodle, you know. If you take one of these things and put in hot, cold water if you in your hand, it's like a wet noodle when it's cold. When it's hot, it straightens out very suddenly. It's quite strong stuff.
In fact, nitinol, a nickel-titanium alloy, can spring back with a force of 55 tons a square inch. The actual phenomenon itself is not yet fully understood. An engineer at the laboratory's Ridgway Banks set out to build an engine to harness this. In a small workshop across from his office, he designed and built a wheel with nitinol loops hanging from the spokes. He calculated that if he filled a container with cold water and another with hot water, the loops of nitinol moving from one bath to the other would bend, then spring back, and that the sudden spring of the nitinol in the hot water would drive the wheel around, thus becoming the world's first solid-state heat engine. He was right. This simple crankshaft wheel first began spinning one morning in November 1973 at the Lawrence Laboratories, Berkeley, marking the first time that heat had been converted directly into mechanical energy. Ridgway Banks rigged up a solar heater on the laboratory roof to keep the water warm enough to drive the engine and let it run to see if there would be any sign of fatigue in the nitinol wires. After 23 million revolutions, he found that the wheel was running stronger. No one is quite sure why this is happening. Professor Macmillan reported the nitinol phenomenon in 1974 at a special meeting of Nobel Prize-winning scientists in Germany. We'll talk with Professor Macmillan about this in our next science report.
This gets better and better. It doesn't wear out.
And we'll talk with the inventor of the first nitinol engine, Ridgway Banks.
And a metallurgist who has a long background in this attended a talk that I gave at MIT years ago, and I was trying in a sort of stumbling way to relate this to other solid-state things that I thought might tie in here. And he said, don't wonder where it comes from. He said, it's a gift from God. Just accept it. Use it. Don't worry about what's going on.
Lawrence Laboratory physicist Dr. Harry Heckman was there when the wheel first spun round. He remembers his reaction.
I'll be damned. Oh, sure, I mean, there it goes. You know, Ridge, you've done it again. And actually, the mechanisms that he did innovation to make the wheel go and the kinematics of the wheel is almost looks like it's perpetual motion.
And Professor Elizabeth Rauscher, a nuclear physicist studying the crystals of nitinol, speculates on why nitinol behaves the way it does.
Ridgway's been trying to look at some of the magnetic properties, some of the ferromagnetic properties that might occur in nitinol. These are experiments that really need to be done to give us some clues as to what's going on.
And we'll talk with Stuart Brand, editor of Whole Earth Catalog, who first drew attention to nitinol in his publication Coevolution Quarterly.
This is a real case of news being so original that the mind, just the social mindset, is taking a while to catch up with it. It's not, nitinol was not predictable from anything else going on at the time. It really was a complete flash.
We'll talk with Professor Daniel Cole, who's investigating ways of using nitinol engines to harness temperature differences in the ocean and geothermal springs, to tap waste heat lost in most industrial processes, and most immediately, a solar-heated nitinol irrigation pump.
What's particularly attractive about nitinol, and that a nitinol prime mover in that circumstance, is that the solar collector has the job only of maintaining about a 20 centigrade degree difference in temperature.
We'll talk with Professor Macmillan about a new machine, another invention of Ridgway Banks, which many believe heralds a completely new energy technology.
The new machine depends on stretching of the wire, the absolutely longitudinal stretch. And that is basically a more efficient mechanical motion. It is important that people are working on these things, you know. If it's used as a basis of a heat engine, of course, you need it in a much entire different scale of production from what it's made now. Fortunately, the materials in which it is made, which are nickel and titanium, are both very abundant elements, so there's no question of rarity of materials. And it's not hard to make. Somebody just has to do it.
The thing about this machine which is important to me is that it's possible to scale this design up efficiently. You simply add more nitinol and you get more power out for the as long as you put enough hot water into it. So this is the first machine that I've personally had anything to do with that could be scaled up to kilowatts or even conceivably megawatts of power.
Research into nitinol heat engines began quietly several years ago with strange devices like this, developed by McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Corporation. Others involved in nitinol heat engine research include the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, the United States Navy, General Motors. Research is also underway in England, Germany, Japan, the Soviet Union, and China. Nitinol can be trained with a double memory to recur to a predetermined shape. In a warm airflow, the branches of this nitinol plate curve out. The force of this transformation has been measured as high as 55 tons a square inch. And in trained nitinol, a cold airflow will cause a reverse reaction. And in some devices, the effect gets stronger with repetition. No one knows why or how far this will develop. But by 1974, some of the researchers working on these devices, a number of which are still classified, were saying in unpublished private and government research papers that nitinol could provide a new means of energy conversion that might have considerable long-term implications. With the sudden advent in the mid-1970s of the worldwide energy crisis, the Department of Energy here in Washington, D.C., began looking for new sources of energy. And in 1978, the Department of Energy, in association with the United States Navy, convened the world's first international conference on nitinol heat engines. It was here at the Navy's Ordnance Laboratories, just outside Washington, D.C., that nitinol was originally produced as part of a little publicized program of metallurgical research for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The Navy has now produced a special report for the Department of Energy on nitinol heat engines, based on their research here at the Ordnance Laboratories Nitinol Technology Center. CNN has learned that the report will recommend the development of nitinol heat engines as a means of helping relieve United States dependence on imported oil.
We see nitinol engines as a real potential for the future. We have done some calculations which show that nitinol is very viable in terms of using waste heat or low temperature heat, which is the largest available source of heat in the United States. Since the energy to run the engines is in effect free, because it's waste heat, you don't have to use oil or anything or any other fuel, it's the cost of installation that's important. We ran some calculations here which suggest that if we can produce nitinol at $200 or so a pound, which is within reason, we feel that you can make heat engines, and these are extrapolated figures, bear in mind, that you can make a heat engine that will recover its own cost if you can run it for 24 hours a day within 2 years, year and a half perhaps. After that, all the energy you get out of it is for free.
It's free.
And that's the driving force behind a nitinol engine.
At the World Bank in Washington, D.C., they've been watching the research into nitinol. Their program is headed by Dr. Mitwalli. I asked him about the Navy's latest figures.
If it's true that it can pay for itself in 2 years, I would say that's very encouraging. But I would like to see that first.
If it looked as though nitinol, in fact, was going to take off, as it were, as an energy source or as an energy converter, would you then choose a particular nation and attempt to see what could be done with nitinol in some large scale?
To start with, if we can have it on its own, or if we can mix it with solar energy, and the end use would be irrigation, pumping, we would be very much interested in the very near future to have something done, and not necessarily in one nation, it could be in many nations in the developing world.
At the United States Department of Energy in Washington, which sponsored the conference, the nitinol research program is headed by Marvin Gunn.
It was, to my estimation, a very successful conference. The proceedings have not been published yet, but they are imminently available. I do know that the proceedings have been put together, and when it comes out, it will represent a very, I think, complete compendium of nitinol state of the art. We went forth with a lot of optimism, you know, that, well, while we'll learn a lot, we won't necessarily decide that we've conquered the world and found something that was going to solve all of our problems, but we thought it was interesting enough and it was feasible enough to look at. It's something brand new and it's intriguing. You know, as you say, there's very little known about it, so we can just think of so many ways of finding out more about it, you know.
Do you foresee finally something like a Nitinol economy in certain parts of the world?
I'm not sure what the numbers are in the availability of nickel and titanium, and certainly the manufacturing capability at this point. But I wouldn't want to go that far to think that Nitinol would dominate. In effect, I guess what we consider ourselves now is that we're on a petroleum economy, and and we're trying to find ways of getting away from that. I see it contributing as a component of, you know, one of the ways of displacing petroleum as a primary energy source.
From a preliminary copy of the report, CNN has learned that the United States Navy has told the Department of Energy that the development of Nitinol heat engines would clearly serve the national interest by helping reduce petroleum energy dependence. The report also includes some startling figures suggesting Nitinol heat engines producing power at an estimated $600 a kilowatt are substantially cheaper than both nuclear power and photovoltaic cells. Well, meanwhile, in addition to the release of this report on Nitinol heat engines, which will become available imminently from the government printing office in Washington, the Navy has also released another book made up simply of the several hundred scientific papers that have been published on Nitinol all over the world. And of course, some of the material is unpublished. There are now reports that in at least one laboratory in the United States, they have produced, but not yet published details of, a kind of super Nitinol, a Nitinol vastly more powerful than the material we've been looking at. Well, however that may be, it seems clear that the Nitinol story has just begun. Kevin Sanders, Cable News Network, Science Report.
Okay, so there was that, and Nitinol. Just very interesting. That's a video on YouTube, and it's pretty interesting to watch it. Because it, you know, they can, it just, if it's warm, it just, you can just easily bend it and pull on it and it just stretches out or whatever. You can bend it any way you want to, and then you cool it back down and it instantly snaps back to the original shape, you know, with really remarkable. So, anyway, I think I'm going to go ahead and cut this off and see if I can't, I don't know, I may lay down and try to sleep. I don't know that they've even started loading this load yet. And I don't know what the weather is doing. At some point, the weather obviously is going to get here, or it's going to at least get to an area that I'll probably have to drive through. So, you know, I'll just deal with whatever happens. What, you know, if it gets too bad, I'll simply stop and, if I don't feel safe, I'll just stop and wait until till I do feel safe. And that's kind of the way it works. And that's really what the company wants. They leave it up to the driver. The whole point is to get it there. The whole point is to arrive and everything's intact and so on and so forth. And so they never complain if I tell them that I or anyone else tells them that things are too dangerous, don't feel safe. Then they say, you know, by all means, let us know when you can go again, is what they always say. And it doesn't happen that often that I have to pull over, but it has occasionally. It does happen occasionally, and it has happened this winter. Remember, I was back in January. I was stuck for about a day and a half at the Pennsylvania-New York state line, or close to it. There, because they had the New York State Thruway closed down from Pennsylvania state line over to the Buffalo area. So it happens, and it may happen again. It's obviously it can snow. I've seen it snow pretty big snow one year on April the 3rd. And the reason I remember that, I don't remember what year it was, sometime in the 90s, but I don't remember what year it was, but the reason I remember it was April 3rd is because that's my birthday, and it did snow. And I remember another time on my birthday, I was trapped in Wyoming for about a day and a half because, big snow came through, and I think I was between Cheyenne and Laramie. I can't remember now. But big snow came through there, and they closed the Interstate 80 down for about a day and a half. And so I was at a truck stop, and that's where I was at. So it can happen. So we'll just kind of play it by ear. But so far, it's still, I'd say it's still probably upwards of 50 degrees here, and there is no precipitation yet, but I'm sure it's getting closer. So anyhow, hope everyone is having a great weekend, and I will catch you later.
Remember, Trucker Tom is like Visa. He's everywhere you want to be.
Product reviews, restaurant reviews, photos, opinions, and more. Visit Trucker Tom's website at www.truckerphoto.com. You've been listening to Trucker Tom's podcast, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. All you have to do is send us an email to tom@truckerphoto.com.